Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Hottest Hits 45 FM Los Angeles.
102.3 FM Riverside.
And 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I am Al Warren. Mr. Brian Turnoff. Brian Turns is here today to be the co-host.
Well, hello. And technically, it's pronounced Turnoff, but Turnoff. I'm not going to correct you on your own show.
Well, it's the Turnoff.
the Turnoff.
Well, I don't quite get because now you've changed your name to Turns on social media.
Brian That's Turns. To keep away creeps like you. Unfortunately, we're already connected, so then block you and then
why? Well, people
friend
are
friend you. It's more of a hassle. But yes,
they're coming after you because you're called Turnoff.
And no. Just like out of nowhere, like a bunch of people from high school, from you know, God knows, decades ago, started trying to reach out, and I'm like, I don't know why we're connecting now, but try to minimize that. I would say.
Yeah, they didn't like you back then. Why would they like you now?
Why pretend now? Exactly. All these years later, clearly I still have a scar about it. But no, I just decided that it was time to go a little more private in today's. Lack thereof privacy.
Well, there you go. So now we know. Now everyone knows. Everything.
I was going to say, and then you just threw out the name there, so I'm going to have to now revert back to my old one, I guess.
Yeah, change it to the game.
Thanks, Al.
You're welcome. That's what I'm here for. I'm here to be helpful and bring charm. Charm and pleasure to everyone.
That's one way of putting it, for sure. Yeah. That's one way of framing that.
Well, now we're going to continue that, with charm and pleasure. And today we're welcoming a guest who's written a book called Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan, Infernal Wisdom from the Devil's Den. So, Mr. Carl Abramson, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Hopefully you say that at the end of the show.
We'll see.
Well, Carl, this is interesting because it can be kind of a controversial subject, and Church of Satan can be kind of a controversial thing to talk about. So how did you decide to write a book on it?
Well, it had to do with my long relationship and friendship with the founder of the Church of Satan, obviously Anton LaVey. It is a long and winding story, but to make that a fairly short story is that when I was a young teenager in Sweden, I was interested in the things that were, dangerous and provocative and, as you are when you're a teenager. And one of these huge topics was occultism. And underneath that, big umbrella called occultism, you come across Satanism, and specifically LaVey's brand of Satanism, and again specifically through his book The Satanic Bible, a book that came out in 1969 and hasn't really gone out of print since then. I found all of that stuff very cool. I found him cool as a kind of an American icon and an anti-hero in a way, and a counter-cultural hero. There were so many interesting facets, so I became fascinated. And then what happened was that when I started a band, because that's what you do, when you're young, you start a band. And I wrote a song about LaVey's relationship with my teenage paramour or object of teenage lust, Jane Mansfield, the beautiful actress. And, you know, they had a fling, they had a relationship, and she was a member of the Church of Satan. So I wrote a song about that. And then a mutual friend, me and LaVey, the British musician Genesis Peorage, said that when that record came out, you should send that record to LaVey. I'm sure he will appreciate it. And of course, I had nothing to lose, so I did, and I didn't expect anything to happen, because it was just, you know, a rock and roll song, and I knew he didn't like rock and roll. But anyway, I got a beautiful letter back from Anton LaVey, you know, and my mind was blown at this time. And things happened pretty fast. I saved up money and I went over to San Francisco in 1989. And that's when I met him for the first time. And I'm sure he was curious about who I was. And I wasn't sure whether I would be sort of, you know, welcomed back after that first initial visit. But anyway, it developed into a beautiful friendship and one that I have cherished, very much all throughout my life. And then, you know, he died in 1997 and, you know, life takes over and you start a family and, you know, these things happen. But I would say some between five and 10 years ago, I had these thoughts, you know, wow, why was this so inspirational for me? And you know, what actually happened during these visits, because I was there like almost every year during the early 90s. And I decided to basically interview friends from then who had been there with him also at the same time, but also other people that I knew were there but that I didn't know personally. And that turned into the project Into the Devil's Den, which is a documentary film. And anyone who works with film knows it's a bitch. You know, you have to cut away so much material. So I decided I want to make a book out of this and use more of the interview material that I had. And that's the foundation of this book that just came out, Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan. So it's basically my original curiosity and my being mind blown about hanging out with him. And, you know, it was beautiful, but gradually changed inside me into thinking about, why was this so impactful? How did it change my life? And, you know, why do I still hold it in such high esteem in a way? That's the basis of it.
Well, what did you think of him before you met him? And what did you think of the Church of Satan? Did you have any serious thoughts on it, or were you pro them or negative, or did you have any sort of feelings?
No, yeah, I was absolutely pro. And the thing is that you can look at this from many different perspectives. One is, for instance, you know, the philosophy or the magical system of the Church of Satan. And then you can look at him as an American, you know, countercultural icon in a way. And all of these things interested me. I was very interested in magic as a phenomenon, you know, as a possible tool of transformation, but also as a phenomenon in our culture and in previous cultures. And he was something who brought something very new to the magical table, meaning that he didn't rely on old arcane patterns and old wisdoms from medieval times and, you know, Pythagorean mystics and that kind of thing. But basically, he came up with his own thing, which he codified and called Satanism. And it's basically a very kind of egotistic philosophy and egotistical magical system, which is pleasure-based. It's very Epicurean in a way. And the using these sort of dramatic symbols of, you know, Satan and these sort of names from, Judeo-Christian history, basically, but also from other parts of the world. You know, so that's one thing. I felt it was very fresh. But then him as a person, I knew that he was very, you know, intelligent, a great musician, had a great sense of humor. And all of these things, I'm very, very happy that I could, get to experience firsthand and see that it was true. It was not some, you know, little fan club that tried to, you know, laud him and boost him but it was a real congregation of really nice, intelligent people who were doing very interesting things. So I was pro from the beginning in my youthful, you know, curiosity, and that feeling is still with me after having experienced, you know, him and the Church of Satan.
Was he all what you expected? Like when you actually met him, were you surprised or were you totally getting what you thought you were?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, at the time when I met him the first time in 1989, you know, he was 59, which is not really, you know, that old, but I could see that he was a bit, you know, failing in health. So my first experiences, the secondhand experiences of him were through, there's an old documentary from 1969 called Satanis, and I'd collected a lot of, you know, archival material in terms of interviews and photographs, and they usually had him in his prime, sort of late 60s, early 70s, when he was completely flamboyant and completely out there in, you know, manipulating media in a way and being in all the, on all the talk shows and Johnny Carson and all the magazines and men's magazines. So my first impressions were more of that guy who really knew how to handle the media. But the person I got to meet was, of course, that's later in life. So he was a bit more, he wasn't a recluse, but he was reclusive. You know, he liked to stay at home, play music. He was a great musician and hang out with friends. And I think what happened at this time, specifically maybe throughout the 90s, was that he hung out with a younger generation, basically, because I think it vitalized him. See, you know, him seeing his ideas getting a new audience in a way, but also perhaps as being fertile soil to take his ideas and seed and, you know, concepts on. And I felt at the time that it was just remarkable, and that he was really, you know, a fantastic, nice human being, but also a great magician in the sense that he had something. He had worked with the codification and conceptualizing radical philosophical and the magical ideas. And of course, he had written books, but there are other ways of leaving legacies, and that's through living people. You know, the people that he met at that time, most of them are, you know, still alive and doing things like, you know, I just wrote this book, for instance. So it's sort of carrying on, I wouldn't say perhaps not a legacy, but certainly carrying on the spirit of his endeavors, you know, whether they be magical or philosophical or just simply artistic, you know, because he was also a great you know, fantastic musician, for instance, and like to paint, and, you know, just very creative individual. And I can feel that as time moves on, that he's probably more well known today than he was 10 years ago and 20 years ago. And then suddenly we're back almost into the heyday when he was very, very famous. So I think at the time when he died, there was a kind of a dip, but now he sort of resurfaced in the I don't know, almost in the mainstream, I would say.
Yeah. You think that's a good thing? You think it's good to have them out and
absolutely
for people to find out?
Yeah, because it's a viable alternative that for me, you know, I'm not a spokesperson, you know, neither of him nor of the Church of Satan, but I think it's just so filled with common sense. If you look at it, it's like in the book, I call him America's Pop Nietzsche. You know, he sort of brought Nietzschean ideas into a more, you know, I think I call it bringing the, you know, Nietzsche into the American living rooms, or into the American TV couches in a way, basically popularizing these ideas that don't necessarily have to be highfalutin philosophical ideas. But what are these ideas? They're about empowerment, individual empowerment, in a similar way that other Americans have. You know, Ayn Rand, for instance, has been instrumental in affecting, you know, American culture and American society. Some people don't like it. Many people do. But you can never look away or shy away from the fact that her ideas have affected American culture as, you know, the ideas of LaVey has done that too. And of course, Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and all these people who created this original impetus for the philosophy of will, basically, they are complicated, but they seems to be that they always become more and more disseminated for each generation that studies them and express their, you know, condensed version of their philosophies for the modern times. And that's exactly what LaVey did. He was a condensator and a filter in a way. And then, of course, you could say, you know, why do you have to call it Satanism? Why do you have to use that symbol? Well, you know, I think he wanted at the time, meaning mid-60s, he wanted to have attention for the group, for himself, to have a career based on controversy and, you know, a cultural public presence. And he certainly got that. And it did become all of those things. It did become a career. It made the book sell. It made the Church of Satan grow. But at the same time, the main thing for him was always the dissemination of his philosophy, which is basically, you know, you have to find out what you want to do in your life, and then you just have to do it. No compromises, no holds barred, because otherwise you will be prone to and subjected to neurosis and problems within yourself, because you know what you want to do, but you're not doing it. That's a problem. That's a big problem in Western culture. So I think he was filled with common sense. He was controversial, he was provocative, and he used these terms that obviously are not to everyone's liking, but he did it to break through a kind of a veil of passivity, of a pacified public in a way. And I think he did manage to pierce that enough to create fairly big interest.
The Anton LaVey of the 60s and the Anton LaVey of the 90s, I imagine they have some fairly big differences. I mean, how did his opinions change over time about Satanism, Church of Satan, and all the things he practiced initially?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, because as we all know, is that we don't remain exactly the same, and you know there are no there's no standard time for when you like peak in life. This is my peak when I'm 31 or 35. We all have our ups and downs, and we all change as persons. But of course, he concocted this philosophy. Sometimes he called it the religion. Other people have called it the religion. But anyway, the Church of Satan and the philosophy of Satanism. He concocted that certainly in his prime, and he lived in it, and he promoted it, and they created a big buzz. Then, of course, you know, time moves on. You have to deal with other things, focus more on family, these kinds of things. And then, of course, you grow older and you may grow infirm. And the exteriors of the outside world may not develop to your liking. I can feel that to a great, you know, extent myself today. I'm 56, and I don't look at the world the same as when I was 23. That's just natural. So what I could perceive in him was perhaps that he was even more misanthropic in a way when I met him. He was sensitive to the, you know, stupid things in media. And I think to a great extent, he tried to avoid reading newspapers and watching TV and stuff like that. He just believed that it dumbed you down. And I can agree with that. There's really nothing good comes from reading about, you know, too much stupidity. Whereas in the past, meaning the 60s and the heyday, I think he was more prone to, you know, pick a good fight and be present in that public arena where you could be in on stupid talk shows on TV or radio and just meet these opposers or whatever, people who were obviously critical, but he gained from being part of that, dialogue of diametrical opinions in a way. When I met him, he was much more, you know, pleased to be at home, hang out with friends and talk about these concepts for sure, but not necessarily to go out there and be on TV and radio and media in general. There were a few interviews with fairly big newspapers, But there was also this thing going on at that time, which was called the Satanic Panic. I don't know if you remember that, but that's all of these people sort of remembering satanic sacrifices and all these, you know, horrendous, fantastical stories that the police, you know, pretty quickly debunked. But it did create kind of an atmosphere of paranoia in for everyone who had a divergent opinion. You know, if you weren't, like, you know, a devout Christian, you could be a victim of their hatred, in the sense that, you know, people could make up fantasies about what they had experienced in your presence or whatever, you know, and that's horrible when that happens. But so I think to an extent, he certainly preferred to be within the confines of his own home and safety. And when he looked at the world in the 90s, I could feel that he had a lot more cynicism and misanthropy in a way. The overt sense of humor was perhaps a little bit more subdued.
Do you think he felt his life was under threat somewhat?
Well, yes and no. I wasn't there, you know, present to the extent that I experienced anything like that. But for sure, I mean, you know, he lived in this house on California Street in San Francisco. It's a beautiful little Victorian house that was painted black, and everybody in the neighborhood knew. I mean, he was a San Francisco celebrity, not necessarily infamous, but actually famous. So everybody knew that was his home and the headquarters of the Church of Satan. So, you know, of course, you know, jocks and morons drove by and threw things at the house. So eventually they had to put up like a fence in front of the house. But there were incidents where people were actually shooting at the house too. And when you're inside with your family, I mean, of course that freaks you out. You know, that's just natural. So that may be another reason for him retiring a little bit into his own world and to his own safe environment, understandably.
Do you think the public didn't really understand him, didn't know who he was?
Well, I don't know. The public, what is it? I don't know. It's a vague term. But in general, I think that if you look at interviews, I mean, proper journalistic interviews and documentaries from the time, you know, when the Church of Satan was sort of, say, between 0 and 5 years old, good journalism always has, you know, the pros and cons, the people talking for and against. And it seems to me that San Francisco at this time was, you know, we know that it was a very liberal place, you know, with all the flower children and the hippies and, you know, a lot of experimentation going on. And that later on remained, in the sense that, you know, has always been a place of let's call it gay safety, LGBTQ safe haven in a way. And it has always had that spirit. And I think that for people outside of that environment, like I said, in San Francisco, he was famous, not infamous. Whereas in the rest of America, you know, perhaps in the Midwest, he was certainly infamous. And people perhaps didn't want to understand him. Whereas in San Francisco, there was always this kind of dialogue, you know, what are these people about? And it was more of a, you know, possibility to express your divergent opinion. So I think that, you know, the water always finds its own level, and you know, people didn't only have impressions coming from talk shows and TV and that kind of thing. It was mainly through his books. You know, Satanic Bible came out in 69, followed by The Satanic Rituals and The Satanic Witch, or The Complete Witch, as it was called. And these books were doing well. Like I said, the Satanic Bible has never been out of print since 1969, which is a remarkable feat. So the ideas were spread through the books, and whether people could understand it or take it to heart, obviously some people did. You know, if the books are selling, you know, not all the books are thrown in the trash can. And I think that he also was smart in his networking. He liked to hang out with, you know, movie stars and celebrities and that kind of thing. And you make an impression. And I think he his philosophy also lived on in those impression networks where people, you know, talked about him and that they had met him and about what he had said about his philosophy and stuff like that. And I think for many people, it might have been too, not heady, but perhaps a bit too controversial. You know, like people can say, wow, I really agree with what he's saying, but I'm not going to be out and out Satanist. I'm not going to define myself as a Satanist because it could hurt my career, it could hurt this and that. But LaVey was always very understanding about these weird, you know, foibles and machinations of human culture. So he always said, you know, it would be paradoxical to demand of someone to, you know, claim, you know, define themselves as Satanists, because it's much better to be an a covert Satanist and enjoy that than being a miserable overt Satanist who, you know, always gets criticism or, you know, aggression, where in fact they just want to enjoy life. So it's better to sometimes be quiet about it and just enjoy it in secrecy. That's something that LaVey supported 100%.
Researchers who have looked into his history, they have found some inconsistencies in I guess what we would say the legend and reality of Anton LaVey. I mean, for example, I think he talked about having an affair with Marilyn Monroe, being a worker, working as a photographer for the San Francisco Police Department, and yet there's no real evidence for that. I mean, how do you, as a fan and a friend, reconcile that?
Yeah, well, there are two ways to look at that, according to me. And first of all, you have to look at what kind of person he was and what kind of person he wanted to be and what kind of, you know, persona he wanted to emulate in a way. And he came from a background where he didn't go to college. He worked on a circus and a sideshow, which has been completely verified. You know, he worked with big cats, lions, and tigers, and also played as a circus and sideshow musician. He was very skilled. That was actually his main profession as a musician. And in that world, you know, there's this thing where, you know, it's the greatest and it's the amazing and it's the legendary. You know, you have these PR discourse, which is necessary to attract people. So he was, you know, the great Shandor, because his name was Anton Shandor LaVey. And he lived in that kind of thing and developed in that kind of beautiful world of exaggeration in a way. So there's a wonderful expression that is usually called when some people are trying to define themselves in a way that might shock other people, is that they tell a truth and a half, meaning they exaggerate a little bit to create a persona that is something that they want to achieve. Everybody does it daily who work, you know, in social media and with selfies and trying to present something that they're not, you know. The thing is that for LaVey, it was a conscious thing. It was not something pathological. He was just leading a larger than life life. And that was provocative enough for people to question whether all of these things that he had actually experienced was true or not. As for the people who you know, claim that, I mean, that's one thing. And then if you want to go into details and sort of nitpick about various things, I know for a fact that in the archive of the Church of Satan, there are, what do you call them, slips from salary payments from the San Francisco Police Department for his photographic work. And I'm sure they could drag that out if they want to. As for flings and romances with Marilyn Monroe, isn't this merely a matter of of envy? You know, because do people really think that Marilyn Monroe did not have casual sex while she was working as an exotic dancer or in her young life? Of course she did. As do many women and many men. So I can't see why it would be such a problem. Because he was there at the same time. He did play music at the Mayan and other clubs where she was actually dancing. So I don't know. I can't see it as a problem. Many of the things that have, you know, people have tried to debunk. They themselves have been debunked by simple facts and, you know, historical records and stuff. That's not saying that everything he said should be taken at absolute face value, because again, he liked to tell a story and a half, and that's usually what great storytellers do. They tell a story in a way that is simply so fascinating and enigmatic and alluring in a way. And you don't really do that by journalistic reporting. You do it by literary means. And that's how I look at him. I know for a fact that he certainly entertained me. And if he had great things in his house. He claimed to have, you know, Chico Marx hat and showed it to me. You know, if that's not Chico Marx's hat, I really don't care, you know, because to me it was. So in that sense, I wouldn't call those things absolutely not lies. I would call them, you know, very interesting objects that can bring out entire stories from someone who absolutely led a fantastic life, really a larger than life life.
What's your favorite memory of Anton, personal memory?
I think I would have to say moments in his kitchen, which is where he had these racks with all his synthesizers. And it was so amazing because being a kind of a musician myself in that kind of experimental way that was, you know, quite common in the late 80s, basically meaning you can't play, but you use synthesizers to sort of create soundscapes or whatever. But here was someone who had a great amount of synthesizers, some of which were quite modern, you know, and he had programmed them all with sounds that sounded like really old instruments, like from bands from the 40s and circus music and these weird, weird sounds. And then, of course, that's all fair and fine. But he was an amazing musician. And again, I mentioned Chico Marx's hat. I mean, there was a lot of Chico Marx in him when he was playing, you know, this kind of thing where they're playing music on the keyboards, but at the same time, it seems their fingers are having a life of their own, like really dancing on the keyboard. And that kind of thing, he was just so involved in the performance that you couldn't help but just, you know, stand there and laugh hysterically because it was so much fun. And he was also someone who could, like, for instance, one occasion I asked him, well, you know, can you play something Scandinavian because I come from Sweden? And just he just hammered out a tune that, you know, certainly was, I recognized this as a hambo. It's a kind of a folk dance thing. And I recorded that and I called that the Satanic Hambo. But then a couple of years later, I realized this is actually an old Danish Christmas song. And I just wondered, how the hell could he know that? You know, have some Danish Christmas carol or song in his mind that when I asked him, he could just hammer out. That's an amazing ability that some musicians have. It's not only that they can play, but they have music in their own repository, in a way, in their mind. So those moments were really fantastic because that's when he really shone. He was very, very happy and joyful. And you could see that that was his main passion in life.
Did you ever participate in any, you know, like magical rituals with him?
Yeah, you could. That's a matter of definition also. If you look at it from, you know, going into this, you know, dark chamber and there are people in hoods and the nude lady on the altar and stuff like that, that didn't happen then. That sort of ended in the mid-70s in that kind of flamboyant way. However, there are some definitions that I find more appropriate, which I think stem from the British magician Aleister Crowley, who said that, you know, magic is the you know, art and science of causing change to occur in conformity with will. Basically, anything that you do that promotes your desired goal is an act of magic. And in that sense, yes, we talked about things and we hung out and strengthened certain things and So in a sense, we created something together that led to certain things. Absolutely. I did also get married. I traveled there 1 year with my girlfriend at the time, and I asked if, you know, he would be if he could consider to wed us, and he did. So in that sense, we had some kind of, I don't know, taste of what it was like back then when he was actually in that kind of the mode of the priest in a way. But it was very romantic and sweet and just very amazing to be a part of that. But there was no like flamboyant hocus pocus going on, no.
Mm-hmm. Oh, darn it. So do you think the Church of Satan is quite a bit different now under Peter Gilmore than it was with LaVey, and I mean in sense of rituals and things like that?
Well, I think that you have to look at it in part, you know, the people who are running it, but also in the times we're in, you know, meaning both an internal and an external perspective. And things changed very rapidly, I think, after LaVey died from that external perspective, mainly having to do with the internet and this, the rapid development of life and culture and communication and congregation and human culture basically taking place online. And I think that Peter Gilmore, Peggy Nadremia, and also Blanche Barton, who was LaVey's partner, basically the people who are leading the Church of Satan, they were quick to realize that, you know, this is not an option. You know, we just have to have a strong internet presence. And that is, I would say, the key thing today, to have a site that's completely informative, transparent, fun, keep a good archive, basically allowing people who are curious to get all the answers they need by spending some time at the site. And then in terms of leadership in general, I don't envy anyone in that position. It must be hard, mainly because of perhaps online criticism. I mean, it's so easy to be critical online. But on the other hand, I think they're very used to it, and the organization is certainly doing well, and it seems very stable and, you know, well run. It's a functional thing. So I think that LaVey, if he had lived longer and then perhaps remained in power, but perhaps wasn't strong enough to truly go with the flow of technology and stuff like that, he was interested in it, absolutely. I mean, it's just pure speculation. Maybe it would have taken longer for the Church of Satan to adapt to the modern times. But, you know, that didn't happen. And what happened was that the Church of Satan is now a very active and sort of contemporary presence.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter Gilmore almost had me joining, but when he said there wouldn't be a big pile of guys coming here with capes to have sex, I was like, oh, no.
Well, you can do that on your own free time, right?
Well, I know. That's what he said.
That's why he started the House of Mystery.
Yeah. I can do that myself. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I mean, but, what went on in the Black House, as you call it? Like, what kind of things would go on there? What was it just sitting around having coffee, or what happened?
I can only speak for myself and what I experienced, and it was usually at this time the same kind of MO, you know, the same kind of modus operandi, which was everything happened at night or began in the evening and went late, and you would come by and we would have maybe a coffee or a drink at the Black House and just chit chat, and then knowing that we would go out for a late dinner, driving to some great restaurant. You know, San Francisco at this time was very, very nice. And then returning to the house for let's call it hanging out. That meant watching movies, talking a lot, watching him play music, and just being filled with, I don't know, it's very much an old school kind of conversation that never really ended. It was very I felt that he was equally interested in what I had to say as I was, obviously, to hear what he had to say. And that, you know, of course, is inspiring when you're a younger person and you're looking up to this older person. And he was so filled with stories. It was a joy to listen to and ask questions, you know. And then what could happen was also like, you know, 2 a.m., there could be a buzz on the door, and then someone would come in who, you know, had been out to a party or whatever and come by for a little bit of chit-chat and then just go again, you know. So it was very social, but it was low-key. There was no, you know, no heavy drinking, nothing spectacular in that sense. It was kind of calm and based on conversation. Regardless if we were watching movies or enjoying his music, it was a free-flowing dialogue of many, many interesting topics.
So when someone picks up the book and takes it home, what are you hoping that they take away from this book?
Well, I'm hoping that it's a little bit like an antidote to his usual presence. I can see that changing, but I'm thinking specifically he was on one of the more recent seasons of American Horror Story, for instance, this kind of youthful horror TV series. And, you know, as this sort of bad guy, Satanist, you know, demonic, but it looked like him and he was introduced as him. And that creates kind of a cheesiness to, yeah, I don't know, it takes away a little bit of the potential that the Lavayan philosophy has to really inspire people. But then on the other hand, I'm not sure he would agree. I think that Lavey would be happy about the fact that he's in a way honored, because he was used to being ridiculed or bad-mouthed. And I think he ascribed very much to, you know, the Mae West, the philosophy of Mae West and Jane Mansfield, that there is, you know, there's only publicity, there's no bad publicity. So I hope that my book can be kind of a substantial antidote to the cheesiness that with which he's usually presented, because my book is the first 4 or 5 chapters are my own recollections and my own feelings of having been there and what we talked about and just the hanging out aspect. And then for the film originally and also included in this book are all my interviews with people who were there at about the same time. And some, you know, some perspectives differ, but in general, we all shared the same experience, because being there was kind of, it was the same for everyone. But it seems that he sort of read us or scanned us, and he sort of presented us with the stuff that I think he thought intuitively that we would be prone to or interested in, yeah, I don't know, carrying on in a way. I remember specifically him taking books by Ben Hecht, you know, the famous screenwriter from the 30s and 40s, books that he had written about more philosophical topics and some old horror fiction that he had written. And he took those books out and he read to me. And I mean, how often does that happen, that someone reads to you from a book, you know? That's something that your parents do in a way, yeah, if you're lucky. But that was so special. And of course, I loved Ben Hecht then, and I love him even more now. But it was just so, that was one of those seeds that sort of grew on me. Like, why did he do this? Did he really want me to carry on the kind of a Ben Hecht energy or whatever? And other people had other things, you know, they were presented with other things, like the photography of William Mortensen, that those seed actually grew over the decades to become beautifully published books on and by William Mortensen through publishers, young publishers who were there at about the same time as me. And there are other examples of that. So the interviews in the book, people who experience that talk about their own experiences. Some things we shared, some things we don't. But the book gives, I think, a very accurate picture, not in a critical or analytical way, but it gives an insight into the human being that he was to us. It's not an attempt to create like the ultimate biography, but it's a very great piece of history writing, I would say, because it's all based on first-hand sources.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, you know, the philosophy of a human being, and that's kind of what I see him as, and his the way he approached things. But a lot of the, you know, mainstream world, again, we're going back to mainstream, but there's a concept of Anton LaVey as being like a Satanist, where they, you know, eat children and animals and bloodlettings and all this sort of stuff. Do you think they'll ever, people will realize the difference, or that there is a different philosophy?
Yeah, I think so. And I think so. It will be evident and obvious to the people who really have the capacity to understand. Because I have to say, unfortunately, my experience of life is that some people simply don't have that capacity to understand, and they never will. You know, and it's not, you know, it's, we can't, you know, cry over spilt milk or whatever it's called. But the thing is that that's something I think has changed over these past decades, or perhaps the past decade, in the sense that there have been books. Blanche Barton has written a beautiful book called We Are Satanists. That's her... It's a kind of an extension or expanded version of her book called The Church of Satan that came out originally, I think, in 1990. But it's also filled with more stuff. And there's another book was written fairly recently called The Satanic Warlock as a complement to The Satanic Witch. But it's written by a member of the church. So it's sort of the canon, in a way, is being expanded by living authors within that environment. So that's a very healthy thing. And therefore, I think that it will never be a static or inert environment where people can sort of project their own fears or foibles or prurience or all of these things on something that cannot, in a way, defend itself, because it is still a very vital and thriving group and philosophy. And what I hope that my book can bring to that table is, again, is that showing him what he was really like for all of us who actually were there. You know, so in that sense, I think that the people who have the capacity to understand that and also to take part of this material, I think they will see him in a more nuanced light than 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago. And I think that he will come forth in a way as what I called at the beginning of the show as you know, a countercultural icon in a way. Yeah, back then he was controversial in a group of many controversial people. They could be, you know, anything from, you know, Allen Ginsberg was controversial, the hippies were controversial, Tim Leary was controversial. They were all on par, perhaps representing different things, but they were part of a countercultural wave in America at the time, mid-60s to mid-70s, basically. And LaVey had his particular niche. And I certainly think that he belongs up there with the greatest of them. And I think he would agree. I don't think he agreed so much back in the day, because he wouldn't want to be associated with those people. But I think looking back at that, you know, specific slice of American history now, there were key people who created a lot of change in American society, and I certainly believe that he was one of them. You know, and I think that people today can now begin to understand that, because they can be unaffected by the prejudice of morons, and they can themselves take part of first-hand material.
So how do people get a hold of you or find your book, or do you do social media?
Absolutely. What's out there? Yeah, I think the best thing, if people want to get in touch with me and all the social media presence, is simply through my website, which is carlabrahamson.com. That's Carl with a C and Abrahamson with two S's, carlabrahamson.com. And that takes you on to all kinds of things, you know, links to where they can see the film, for instance, and all my social media stuff. And the book itself is widely available wherever people usually buy their books. If they have good bookstores, they can get it there, or the bookstore can help them get it. Or, of course, go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you buy books. Basically, it's there.
great. Of course, we'll have that up on our website as well. People can find you with one click. You know, it's all there. So, you know, when you look back at this, when you wrote this book and you went through the whole, your memories and you put it together, do you ever notice or realize how much that 10 years or so changed you?
Absolutely. And it wasn't an exclusive thing. I mean, of course, it was an exclusive thing to be invited and invited back to the Devil's Den in a way. But for me at that time, it was a very expansive period of my life when I was deeply immersed in exploring different facets of magic and what I call magical anthropology. So I was having a blast, you know, really talking to, interviewing, meeting a lot of magicians and magical people, philosophers, and LaVey was part of that beautiful cauldron in a way that really affected my life. So, and I think that if I wanted to say, you know, how important was he to me in this cauldron, in this entire spectrum of things that were going on in my life, and I would say that he was like, you know, top three. He was very, very instrumental in my development, and I still carry on a lot of, you know, cherished memories and still inspiration from him and his way of approaching things. He approached things with a sense of humor, with common sense, with a kind of clarity, and especially how he expressed himself. He was very inspired by Ben Hecht, as I said, and also Mencken, Mark Twain, all these beautiful American satirists in a way. You know, you can be very sardonic and critical, but there's always this little gleam in the eye that could be defined, or certainly defined by him, as satanic, you know, poking a finger at hypocrisies, poking a finger at, you know, seemingly pathological neuroses of our culture that could be better. You know, everybody could be better if they weren't so confined to being victims of their own self-deceit. That's how I interpreted his basic philosophy.
Wow, I wonder, I guess it's impossible to really know, but I wonder how he would deal with today's world.
That's the great question. You know, in one part, I think he would have loved it, meaning gloating, you know, gleefully gloating about how far can this go? You know, is this really end times? But he would have a good time, again, poking fun and sort of pointing his finger, not necessarily in a satanically moralistic way, but much more like, you know, I told you so. This thing where you know, and you've known all along, and now you can see it not only on TV, but out there in reality too, that how strange our culture is, how strange American society is, and how weird the machinations of the world, you know, are moving right now. But I would like to quote, you know, something that Blanche says in the film and also in the book about, you know, his misanthropy, because people always refer to him as a misanthropist, and yes, he was. But Blanche said that, you know, I would have to say that he was an idealist, because if he weren't an idealist, he would never have done all the things that he actually did, meaning formulating and disseminating a philosophy that was helpful for people. Because if he were a pure misanthropist, he could just have stayed in his black house and enjoyed life, you know, and enjoyed his own pleasures. But he was out there on the forefront and presenting his, you know, satanic philosophy and these ideas for people to take on if they felt that resonance, and in the hope that it could change their life for the better. And that's really what an you know, kind of an egotistical altruist does, or an idealist does.
Pretty amazing. Pretty good book. Everyone, pick up the book. It's called Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan, Infernal Wisdom from the Devil's Den. And the author has been our guest, Carl Abramson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you so much.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino movie reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.